It's Friday, June 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Barack Obama's free trade agenda faces a key vote in the House of Representatives. The head of the Spokane, Washington branch of the NAACP is revealed to be white. We get an inside look at the maximum security prison in New York from where two convicts escaped last week. Jazz great Ornette Coleman dies. We look back at his storied career. It's all ahead. The clock is ticking on U.S. President Barack Obama's Asia-Pacific free trade agenda as the House of Representatives prepares to vote whether to extend crucial fast-track negotiating authority to the White House. The legislation, known as Trade Promotional Authority, or TPA, would allow the White House to negotiate the 12-nation Asian Trade Pact and others like it without letting Congress make any changes in the deals when they come up for approval or rejection. I'm joined now by VOA congressional correspondent Cindy Sain on Capitol Hill. So, Cindy, how is it going? Has the vote started yet?
No, Sarah, the vote has not started yet. I'm watching just outside the chamber here, and actually one of the most critical people, House Democratic Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, is on the floor right now. And being the Democratic leader, she carries tremendous sway and influence. And President Obama came to Capitol Hill personally just an hour or so ago to meet with House Democrats, to meet with her, and to basically to beg them, to try to persuade them to support this trade agenda, which he has spent so much political capital on. And I must say, Sarah, that Pelosi is still speaking. She hasn't actually said how she's going to vote, but she did say, why should we fast-track this trade authority when we don't have an immigration bill, we don't have a highway funding bill, and she said that she has been a champion of unions and of environmentalists. So at this moment in time, anything could happen, but it's not looking too good for the president and those who would support this trade promotion authority.
Well, now, looking at this, there's an old saying that politics makes strange bedfellows, and it seems to be demonstrated by this, because this has been a partisan Congress, and yet a number of Republicans seem to be siding with the president, and a number of Democrats are opposing him in this regard.
Yes, that's exactly right, Sarah. We also had Republican House Speaker John Boehner on the House floor a little while ago making an impassioned appeal for members to support the bill, saying the U.S. needs to lead, and that if, you know, globalization is happening anyway, and that if, you know, if we step back, if the United States steps back and doesn't support this, and it will be China that is dictating the terms of trade in the Asia-Pacific region. So you have a lot of, you know, what we might refer to as mainstream Republicans who support this, along with President Obama, whom they usually oppose on just about everything. And then you have a lot of progressive Democrats who oppose this, and you have some so-called Tea Party or very conservative Republicans who also oppose this so-called fast-track trade authority, because they say it's giving the president too much power, then Congress could only say yes or no to trade deals and not be able to weigh in on the details.
Yes, now you were saying that President Obama personally has worked to get support for this measure. He's been on the Hill today, but also I think he attended a baseball game last night.
Yes, it's an annual congressional baseball game, and the president was there, and a lot of people are saying that that really raised some eyebrows, and some Democrats are saying, you know, he should have started this much earlier. You had Democratic Representative Keith Ellison tweeting, now President Obama wants to talk, basically, you know, hours before the vote, and some people are saying that the president has been a bit aloof and standoffish. You know, he's not known as one who likes to come over a lot and sort of make a point of trying to sway or trying to smooth members. And some see this as perhaps too little too late.
What impact could this TPA have on Mr. Obama's legacy?
Well, he himself has you know, staked so much on this, and I think he raised the stakes again by taking the rather unusual move of coming over to the Hill personally. And he has said that this is a key element for U.S. leadership in the world, for the U.S. economy, for, you know, even national security and American leadership and America's reputation in the world. So the stakes for him are very high. I think this is probably one of the last most high-profile issues for President Obama.
All right. Thanks very much. That's Cindy Sain reporting from Capitol Hill. Well, joining me in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky with a look at what's trending today. Andrew, what's happening?
A teen in the U.S. state of Virginia pleading guilty to supporting ISIS, but it's interesting how he did it. Ali Shukri Amin was advocating for ISIS on Twitter and actually taught members of the group how to use Bitcoin, which is the online currency that ISIS is using to pay for a lot of things because they can't use banks. So he was in court yesterday about that, but it's interesting that here, even in the U.S., we're having these cases of social media assistance. They may not be traveling overseas to help ISIS, but they're helping them online.
Huh, interesting.
Absolutely. Another story I wanted to bring up and another hashtag that's trending here in the U.S. is hashtag transracial. Now, this is a story out of the U.S. state of Washington. A woman named Rachel Dojol. She is apparently a white woman, but was pretending to be an African-American, a leader of the NAACP chapter in Spokane, Washington, which is the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. It's an African-American advocacy organization. She was pretending to be African-American and saying, well, even though I was born white, this is the race that I feel that I am. And so this hashtag transracial has been trending, people comparing it to being transgendered, saying if you can be born in a body that is not the gender that you feel you are, why can't it be the same for race? So it's prompting a lot of ridicule for her. A lot of people saying, no, this is not the same as being transgendered. It's completely different. But a lot of discussion online on Twitter. So this topic causing a lot of debate. And again, we're seeing how social media can be this forum where people can talk about these issues and raise these issues.
That is interesting.
Yeah. And then finally, we'll end with a light note, because it is Friday here. Hashtag Apple Watch pool prank. There's a gentleman, his name is Troy Sivan. He is an actor, a South African actor, but he's actually better known for his YouTube videos. And what he did was his brother had ordered the Apple Watch. He took the watch out of the box, filled the box with apples, and pretended to accidentally drop the box in their pool and watched his brother freak out and film that and then... His brother opened the box, saw it was filled with apples. But this video is going all over viral on the internet. People are sharing it, laughing about it, and saying it's kind of mean, but also pretty funny.
Wonder how the brothers will get along now.
Huh? Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah.
Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers in northern Chile at the European Southern Observatory's Very Large Telescope, or VLT, snapped some sharp images that for the first time showed the birth of a bipolar planetary nebula. A nebula is a cloud of ionized gas that has been ejected by a red giant or a dying star. The red giant that spawned the butterfly-like planetary nebula is called L2 Puppis. It's only 200 light-years away and is one of the closest red giants to Earth. The new images also clearly show a nearby but dimmer and smaller companion star. The researchers believe that the companion star played a role in creating the bipolar planetary nebula, which was produced by the enormous quantity of dust circling the dying star. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, tributes are paid to a jazz legend. In upstate New York, the hunt continues for two escaped convicts who fled the maximum security Clinton Correctional Facility last week. VOA's Adam Phillips joins us from our New York bureau. So, Adam, what's the latest in this case?
Well, the latest is small, but it's promising. They did find the dogs that they're using, these hounds, did find a scent of the gentleman's, the convict's footprints, maybe I shouldn't call them gentlemen, at a gas station, a mobile gas station, not very far from the facility. So they're hoping that they'll be able to pick up the scent even further, although as the days progress, the scents get weaker and weaker, obviously.
Is it thought that they're still together?
People don't know if they're still together. There wasn't a, they didn't notice two different scents that diverged. So I guess the assumption is they're either together, or if they're not together, then that makes their life obviously a lot, you know, the searcher's life a lot more complicated. But I don't think they really know. They're still scratching their heads, hoping for the best, and grabbing any piece of string they can to wrap this thing up.
Well, I would think that officials, police officials, and others are hunting for these two, that they're probably hoping that eventually they'll just tire out, or they'll run out of food, or whatever, and you know, and they can be apprehended.
Well, there has been a huge media blitz, obviously. There's a lot of fascination and a lot of fear around this thing. So people are extremely motivated to know what these people look like and to report any suspicious pair that they see. People have sent in tips from as far away as Philadelphia, which is, you know, many hundreds of kilometers south of where this is happening near the Canadian border in New York State.
And how are the area residents coping with all this?
Well, it's a gun country, which is true of a lot of rural America. They're loading up on their guns. They're looking around and making sure that nobody's in the woods. People sort of tap on the trunks of their car to make sure that nobody's hiding. But it's also kind of a hard scrabble town, too. Most of the people who live there either work at the prison or know somebody who's worked at the prison. So there's kind of a steely fear that's pervading the town. The schools are still closed and traffic is still snarled up. They have these roadblocks and, you know, people are on high alert, but I think that they're getting through.
Yeah, and is there any more about the woman who is believed, who have worked at the prison, who is alleged to have helped them?
Yeah, there's nothing more about her. I mean, she's sort of been underneath the radar. Apparently, she's been cooperating very, very fully with authorities. And I've been reading a lot of conflicting reports about whether she actually confessed to giving them or enabling them to get the power tools that they needed to make their escape or not. But she's in extremely hot water, and I think she knows it.
All right. Thank you. That's Adam Phillips. Well, VOA Central News editor Candace Williams spoke with Phil, and his last name is intentionally withheld. He was a prison psychiatrist at the Clinton Correctional Facility in New York. Phil describes the facility and how the killers might have fled.
Everybody at the work there is stuck because, see, there's two sections. There's a section that it's the largest maximum security prison in New York State. And it has a big wall around it, 40-foot wall. But next door to it, there's an annex. But nobody has really escaped from behind the wall, ever. You know, there have been some escapes from the annex, which is next door. But no one has really escaped. I mean, this is Shawshank Redemption. I mean, it's the same type of thing. It's eerily similar. It's amazing.
What do you think they were thinking? What's the psychology behind all of this? Manipulate somebody and go?
Yeah. Right. And the other thing is, these guys were on the honor block, which is A block there. You know, were ideal inmates. I mean, they didn't have anybody any trouble for years. And this is how they get into A block. So maybe there was something that they had a plan right from the beginning, because this guy, Matt, has escaped before from other prisons. And maybe they just said, listen, we're going to do low profile, and we're going to end up on A block. But probably, you know, the crimes that these two guys committed, they shouldn't have gotten on the honor block, because they get a little extra privileges, you know. Nothing great, but extra things that they were allowed to do and have, and, you know, be out of their cells and so on.
Could money have changed hands for this to happen?
I imagine so. I know this Matt. I mean, he has connection with Mexico. Did he have a lot of money? And, you know, was it, you know, I don't know. I mean, I would think so. You know, they don't have access to get on the computers and so on. I'm sure that maybe I could get on a computer here and find plans for that place. Maybe they could get somebody to help them with it. I mean, obviously they had to have help. They couldn't have done this without help. But it's just amazing to me because, you know, occasionally I might end up giving medication and you have to go to the blocks. They're the ones that are what they call key blocks. And you know, you just can't imagine nobody here, you know, no correction officer here, this stuff going on. And during the day, they were in the shop, apparently. But, you know, when they did the construction and they're working with construction, there's a lot of noise in there. So maybe somehow at certain times, the construction people and these guys were working on getting out of the back of that cell.
That's Phil. He's a former registered nurse, not a psychiatrist, as I earlier said, at the Clinton Correctional Facility in New York. He was speaking with VOA's Candace Williams. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's premier newsmaker interview program. If you have ideas for guests or topics or want to comment on one of our programs, please write to us at Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. That's Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or if you have access to the Internet, send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is pcusa@voanews.com. We look forward to hearing from you.
The legendary jazz saxophonist Ornette Coleman has died. He was 85 years old. Eric Felton has this look at a man who confused many but inspired many more.
There are few performers who have such an outsized influence on their craft that when you ask a critic who they influenced, the answer comes back like this.
Everybody. Everybody.
That's jazz writer Howard Mandel, author of the book Miles Ornette Cecil, Jazz Beyond Jazz, talking about the jazz saxophone player Ornette Coleman.
Everybody. I mean, Coltrane, certainly. Sun Ra was already there, and it gave him license to do it more. Albert Eiler, Roscoe Mitchell, and Joseph Jarman, and the rest of the art ensemble, Lester Bowie. It doesn't. Gil Evans, Miles, everybody.
In Mandel's estimation, Ornette Coleman, in his playing, in his style, in his approach to life, transformed jazz like no one who came after him.
He just said, I'm not going to worry about the structures and the formalities. I know them or I have a sense of them, but my expression can be direct, and anybody's can be.
Ornette Coleman appeared seemingly out of nowhere. One biographer called him a walking myth. He spoke in a knowing, elliptical style about his music and about life.
Ornette has a brilliant use of language. I mean, it's so unique, the way he speaks and thinks.
Here he is talking about the impact of music in 2008.
Making music is like a form of religion for me because it soothes the heart and increases the pleasure of the brain. And most of all, it's very enjoyable to express something that you can only hear and can't see. That's a pretty good equalization there.
And if his speaking style left some scratching their heads, his music was, to say the least, outside of the mainstream. Summing it all up, Howard Mandel says,
people were puzzled.
Though he personally says he doesn't understand why. Here's Mandel talking about Coleman's 1959 album, The Shape of Jazz to Come.
It puzzles me today why people were puzzled by that record, because it's so melodic and it's so interactive. It really, and the song forms are slightly unusual, but they're nothing disturbing. So I've never understood why that record was considered so radical.
Mm-hmm. but people were puzzled nonetheless. So much so, Mandel says, that some even wondered whether Ornette Coleman was for real.
Many listeners, critics, were very admiring of Ornette's sound and his idealism. But other people thought that he was a charlatan, a con man.
Mandel dismisses that kind of thinking out of hand. Coleman, he says, was simply an original character.
Ornette was born way on the wrong side of the tracks, extremely poor.
Ornette Coleman grew up in Fort Worth, Texas, during the Great Depression, a time when, Mandel says,
there was no expectation for a little black kid in the Depression to make anything of himself. And he must have had an incredible amount of drive and somehow some self-confidence to persist.
All indications are that Coleman was completely self-taught as a musician. But when he arrived on the scene, that is, New York City in 1959, it became clear almost instantly, Mandel says, that this was a gifted, unusual performer.
Ornette shocked the American jazz world. Here was somebody who was completely upsetting the apple cart. And all of a sudden, here comes this guy who's like, doesn't talk like anyone. He doesn't act like anyone. And man, he is making a sound that is raising people's consciousness.
Ornette Coleman, Mandel says, was not in music to be famous. He didn't play jazz to make money. Instead, he was out to prove something to himself and to the world.
The way people live is with this sort of improvisatory sense, and we accept a lot of random elements or elements that don't proceed strictly logically or in a formulaic way, and Ornette just reminded people of that.
For VOA News, I'm Eric Felton.
That's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's been 26 years since China's violent suppression of pro-democracy demonstrators in Beijing's Tiananmen Square. Protesters, many of them students, had gathered in the capital and around the country for weeks to demand political change and respect for the fundamental human rights they were being denied by the government. It is not known how many people were killed in the violent confrontation, which was followed by a roundup of protest participants. Chinese authorities have tried to expunge the event from China's official history by censoring discussion of what occurred and by making sure no commemorations take place on Tiananmen Square. The world, however, remembers the events of June 4, 1989. The world remembers the iconic photograph taken from a Beijing hotel room of a single young man standing up to a Chinese army tank, a photograph that captures the valiant spirit of individuals throughout history who unabashedly demand their rights. In a press statement, State Department spokesperson John Kirby took note of the 26th anniversary of the violent suppression of peaceful protests in and around Tiananmen Square. The United States, he said, continues to call for an official accounting of the victims of these events, the release of those still serving Tiananmen-related sentences, and an end to the harassment and detention of those who wish to peacefully commemorate the anniversary. Mr. Kirby said, while China has achieved social and economic progress since 1989, the United States remains concerned that human rights violations in China continue. We are closely monitoring developments with respect to pending legislation in China relating to national security, counterterrorism, and the regulation of NGOs that appears to call into question China's commitment to increased openness and could, if enacted in current form, result in rights abuses, said spokesperson Kirby. On this 26th anniversary, the United States urges the Chinese government to uphold its international commitments to protect human rights and fundamental freedoms and to end the harassment, detention, and other mistreatment of individuals who peacefully seek justice and fairness, to practice their religion, or to express their views.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.